Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Today's episode is the second and final part of our conversation with Alan Savory, founder of the Savory Institute and one of the most influential voices in holistic management. In part one, we covered Alan's military background, his early ecological work in Africa, and the institutional resistance he faced when challenging deeply held beliefs in both science and policy. Today, we pick up with the practical side of his life's work, how livestock, when properly managed, can regenerate land, restore biodiversity, and stabilize food systems. As Alan said in our conversation, quote, "If your toolbox is empty, what are you going to do? There's nothing else in the human toolbox to reverse desertification other than properly managed livestock," end quote. We'll talk about what holistic management really means, why rewilding isn't enough, and how large-scale land restoration is not only possible, it's happening. You'll also hear Alan's thoughts on how military veterans can play a pivotal role in this movement and why institutions, military, academic, and environmental, need to be radically restructured to meet today's ecological challenges. Let's get back into it. Part two with Alan Savory starts now. Have you had, as a result of that talk with COP26, any countries or provinces come to you and the Savory Institute and say, can you help us be these facilitators?
No, none. It's interesting. It went social, it went viral. It's on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on X, and so on. And it's the first thing I've ever put out that in now approaching 3 years, I haven't had one single word of criticism. Amazing. I've had many people say, good idea. I've had nobody act. Now, in the thing, if you listen to it, I appealed to the new Prince William, because he heads a big foundation and trying to solve the problems. And I appealed to the Royal Society, headed by Sir Adrian Smith. And I said, these two societies or organizations could take a lead on this. Both of them, I've tried and tried and tried, both of them just brushed me off as a crank.
I'm finding it hard to understand. If this was, let's say, this isn't such a crazy idea, right? That you can't prove it through practical application. And my understanding with the work you're doing in Zimbabwe, you've been able to, and many others here in the US that are putting these principles to practice on their small scale, have been able to prove that these processes work. They regenerate land. And so why aren't those case studies sufficient, in your opinion?
Mike, and I understand this, but you are having real difficulty in understanding that institutions are not human. The first institution will be human when we hang it for poisoning people. You can't hang the company. What happens is we elevate and transfer and reward the top people, change, whatever. Okay, I gave you the example of the Christian church. I could have picked every religion once they go to organized status. I gave you the example of the Royal Navy. If you read Eric Ashby's research, all right, basically he's saying it doesn't matter how many lives are lost. The Royal Navy, over 1 million lives were lost of sailors. It doesn't matter how much evidence is produced. It doesn't matter how much proof. It doesn't matter how many trillions of dollars. Nothing changes an institution until the perspective of the public opinion in the institution that the institution defends When that changes, the institution changes. So we've got abundant history, we've got abundant science, everything to support that. But every time, like I'm doing, that you explain that to people, the reaction is the same as yours. Well, I can't understand. Why did they do that? I can't understand. Yes, we can't. I can't understand why the Christian churches have been fighting each other for 100 years. I can't understand any of that. I do now because I know that they are institutions and they're not human. Institutions are incapable of empathy. Institutions are virtually incapable of common sense. Institutions are virtually incapable of ever saying I was wrong.
Do you think that there is beginning to be a groundswell uprising, for lack of a better word, amongst consumers that the food system needs to change?
Yes, there is, but that will take 200 years.
Right.
If you look at, take COP26, what I said there, mm-hmm. I said at this conference, you will get people arguing, debating, you'll get confusion. Now, some of the people will be arguing for energy to produce from fossil fuels or from nuclear or from wind, thermal, whatever. They're arguing for the form of production of energy. Other people here will be arguing for the form of production of food, milk, bread, cheese, wine, grain, whatever. And they will be arguing for food to be produced by farmers based on the biological sciences, mainly ecology. All right. Now, there's another group here, far greater, Goliath and David thing. Mm-hmm. There's another group here that will be arguing for the production of food by corporations based on chemistry and marketing technology. And there will be a group in the middle who are apathetic. Now, as I learned in guerrilla warfare in all my life, if you've got a group who are apathetic, they automatically support the status quo or the majority.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this vast discrepancy. Now, let's assume in the next 50 years of successive COP conferences, the group on the left arguing for farmer production of food grows to, at the moment, it's probably less than 1% of the population. If we're lucky, let's say 5% of the population. Let's say, by some reason, just as you've said, more and more people become aware that the food is causing, just the production of food in America is causing something like 300,000 obesity-related deaths every year. That's greater than America's deaths in two world wars in any year. And there's no alarm, even from veterinarians. What the hell is going on with us? Okay, so even if that group increases and it becomes 10%, 15%, and your institutions change, so what? All they've been talking about is how to produce food, not how to manage complexity.
Mm.
So I can stake my life on it,
yeah,
and say the young generations are in for a very, very rough ride unless we do that, use simple common sense and science and just try what I'm saying. And I'm not even saying you have to accept it. I'm just saying try it. And if I'm wrong, what is the downside? Let's say I was totally wrong and a government or a state developed policy in the citizen interest, like I'm talking of, getting help with the facilitation. They develop the policy entirely. Them, their citizens, their experts. So they do that. And let's say I'm wrong and it ends in chaos like COP conferences and everything. So what? It might have cost us $1 million. It might have cost us a year's delay. Big deal. That's the worst possible scenario. If I'm right, it'll start a domino effect because not a single world leader knows what to do, and they're getting nothing but chaos in the advice they're getting. If I'm right, how will you measure the cost of that? You're going to save billions of lives. Violence the world has never even imagined, as cities collapse now on a global scale when we can no longer feed them. Our present agriculture is the most destructive industry ever in history, more destructive than coal, oil, mining, anything. Our present global financial system is driving environmental destruction. So the upside, if I'm right, and we can solve this simply by addressing the root cause, we won't be able to measure it. So isn't it worth trying?
In the interest of helping some of the listeners understand, Alan, what those practices are that you're advocating, who might not be familiar with it, can you describe some of those that you've advocated for over the years to manage the complexity of nature?
Okay, I'm not advocating any practices. I'm advocating that we address the cause of our practices leading to unintended consequences.
Okay.
So I'm suggesting that. And so let me try and understand the difficulty of people getting something to do. It's like having a bicycle. The more I explain a bicycle, if nobody's ever seen one, it's got these narrow tires, you sit on a saddle, it's got handlebars. The faster you pedal, the steadier it is. Mm. And the more I describe it, the more your listeners would say, this bug is mad. But if I had a bicycle and all of them were with me with a bicycle within 20 minutes, they'd be riding it. So what I'm saying is not theoretical, not hypothesis. It's 100% practical. It's how every human manages their lives and how we manage our lives at scale. Now, I described earlier what happens. So right now, the basic flaw, and the only thing we need to really connect is there two, is when you managing your family, and let's just say like you could be a government or you could be you, a human is managing their family. The first thing you have to do is finance it. If you can't and you go broke and you can't sustain your family, men commit suicide. Okay, so you're just like a government. You've got to finance yourself first. Then you can manage nature to produce the food, the widgets, whatever you produce. All right, now it's the same as the government. Now, when you are managing at the moment, I guarantee, and please, some listener, tell us where I'm wrong. I guarantee that every conscious decision you make will meet a need, a desire, or solve a problem, because all humans do, as we discovered in 1983. The problem is right there. Now, we will never change that. I make every decision in my life to meet a need, a desire, or solve a problem. We will never change the decision making. What we do need to do is recognize that when we're managing our lives, managing anything, which is ultimately what we're doing, all right, the reason for the decision cannot be the same as the context. And it has always been. So that was one of the things we discovered. So what we do when we're facilitating or working with a family is simply sit, like with you, and say, well, who's your family? Who's in it? Does anybody have veto power of your management of your family? No. All right, so it's just you and maybe wife, child, whatever. And we just say, well, how do you want your life to be? Based on your culture, your spiritual values. How do you want your life to be? And we just spell that out. And you know what? It's the same for almost everybody in the world. In India, they're more class conscious than the English. And yet I found in whole villages that everybody at every class in their culture wants the same thing. Right? And then I would say, well, what about the environment? You may not be managing land, or you may be managing land, but everything you eat, everything you consume comes from the environment. And goes back to it. So how would the environment have to be 500 years from now for your descendants to live a life like you want?
Right.
And we just describe that in generic terms. And then I would say, Mike, you're not independent. You need to buy things from people. You need support from people. You need friends, etc. You can't push me with a piece of string. You can't make me trust you. You can't make me support you. You can only be trustworthy. You can only be judged by your behavior. That's what will govern it, not your brand, your marketing, your words.
Right.
So I would talk to you, well, how is your family going to have to be? And then we would have what we call a holistic context. Now you'd continue to make every decision to meet your needs, your desires, solve problems, but in that context. And you get
Right.
completely different results.
Now, I understand you can't give a one size fits all for every context, but let's say the problem, as you described, is desertification, right? What are some of the, let's say the problem is desertification, and you believe livestock in properly managed manners can be the solution to that rather than the root cause of the problem. Describe that to listeners who
Okay,
might not be familiar with that.
all right, so we're describing desertification now. I don't believe that livestock can be the solution to that. I have said we have no option. It is impossible to solve that problem with fire. It is impossible to solve that problem with technology, chemistry, machinery, whatever you like, computers, artificial intelligence. Okay, there's nothing else in the human tech toolbox.
How would you?
Just follow up what I've said. If your toolbox is empty, what are you going to do? How are you going to solve that problem? The only other idea we've ever thought of is what's been called rewilding. Leave it to nature to recover. Great idea. Now, what happens when we do that? If we do that around London, Paris, East, West Coast of America, much of Europe, it's incredible. If we do that in marine environments, we do that in wetlands, it's incredible. There isn't a more powerful tool. Biodiversity returns. But you've got to sustain an economy and you've got to sustain people. So you've got a couple of problems there, but at
Right.
least biodiversity has returned. Now, as research in America proved, history has proved, trials have proved over and over again, if you take two-thirds of the world, that's why I showed a NASA picture of it, right across North Africa, up into China, across into India, right down from Canada, down the Americas, you can see those browner zones. There, the atmospheric humidity is very erratic. And it could be high rainfall or it could be low rainfall. It can be like where I live in Africa, where we get a reasonably good rainfall, but it's 4 months. Then we get 8 months of nothing. All right, so if you're in those environments and you rest the environment, rewild it to let it return to nature, as I showed in the TED talk, the vegetation switches from biological decay to chemical oxidation. And that's why humans, for 50,000 years, since we acquired fire, have tried to correct it by burning. But burning is rapid oxidation, it's a chemical process. We have to restore it to a biological process, and only animals can do that, which in practical terms means livestock today, for most of it. Now,
How do you?
I've discovered that in the 1960s. Not a single scientist has proven me wrong. But I haven't had a single ranching organization support me, not a single farming organization. No institution has formed. Thousands of people in institutions have supported me because we have this institutional problem. So again, we'll keep tending to come back
Sure.
to that, unfortunately. So once we realized in the 1960s that, oh my God, I'm wrong. I've been condemning livestock like all scientists. We're wrong. We have to use them. The dilemma I faced at that time was, how do you do it? We've had thousands of years of pastoralists who domesticated these animals, whose very culture it is, who totally understand their tie to nature, they're indivisible from nature. We've had all of that, and yet they caused the great deserts of the world that defeated cities. Okay, so we know that we can't do it with pastoralism, herding. It's slow, but it dooms us. And then we'd had 100 years of modern science, fencing, grazing systems, experts now really trained, and that had accelerated it. Now, a man called Voisin, a Frenchman, I found his research, and he had studied 200 years of rotational and other grazing systems in Europe and found that they all led to biodiversity loss, even in that environment. But I thought he was right with he had come up with a planning process, saying you have to replace all management systems with a planning process. I can understand that, because you don't run an army on an army system, you run it on planning, any business. So I applied his thinking in Africa and with some plants and so on, and we fell on our faces. We came unstuck. And at that point, I had to analyze why. And I realized Wazan wasn't wrong. He was right. But the planning technique he had for a humid environment was too simplistic for a highly erratic environment, with also thrown into it elephants and buffalo and kudu and waterbuck and lions and all the animals we had in Africa. And so then, because I had very limited resources, I said, what do I do? And so I thought, the only thing I can do is research all the professions and see if any have solved this problem. And I looked at Harvard Business School, other business schools, full of libraries about et cetera, all too academic, all needed too much training, and none of it had dealt with anything like as much complication as we were facing. And then logically, being an officer in the army, as well as an ecologist, I thought, what the hell are they training us in the army? Oh my God, they've solved this problem. Over 1,000 years, the military colleges of Europe have solved this. In the way they train us as officers to plan in immediate battlefield conditions, situations. So I just took Sandhurst training that I was trained in and adapted it to a biological need. That's why in my textbook and everything, I always credit Sandhurst, a military college, for solving this 1,000-year-old problem for humans, more than 1,000. And listen carefully, since we developed that in the 1960s in Rhodesia, and then it spread to other countries, we have never, ever had a failure, because it's got that roughly 1,000 years of military experience behind it as the best possible way to plan the best possible solution at this moment in time with ever-changing situations. Now, we have had thousands of people not do it and say it doesn't work.
I realize you won't agree with advocate, but I'll try to use I'll try to use a theme, right? The general theme of the processes that you communicate to use livestock to return desertified lands to productive economic points on the earth involve keeping those livestock on that particular piece of land contextually relevant for a certain period of time, and then deliberately moving those livestock. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's good enough for a rough thing. It's okay. Just essentially, we found why had what I was discovering was, why had it not deteriorated over millions of years? Why had we built up these deep soils? All the grain growing areas of the world were grassland. Deep soils don't develop under forests, they develop under grasslands. So how had we developed this over millions of years? And the answer was, well, if it all co-evolved, you don't get soil before you get plants, before you get animals, blah, 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 you get them all together, and it co-evolved. And that co-evolution, and I tried to explain that in the TED talk, involved the microorganisms, the soil, the plants, everything. And the key component in it was that those are the areas from which the large, severe grazing animals came, and all of them had the same feature, basically, of running in herds as their protection from pack hunting predators. So if you go to the humid environments of the world, it were forests and shallower soils, you find that the large predators were things like tiger and jaguar. Now, why don't they run in packs? It's because they don't eat insects. And the main herbivores are insects. Now, if you go to the grasslands and the seasonal rainfall, which is most of the world, the main herbivores are insects and large animals. So it's termites and many insects, and it's these large animals. Now, these large animals had lions, cheetahs, all these wild dogs, wolves, all these sort of predators. Now, why did they run in big prides? I mean, in my early days in parts of Africa where I was working this out, in just a day's walking on foot, I've seen over 40 lions. It'd be rare to do that today. Now, those lions were supported by thousands of buffalo and other heads of game. And what was the protection? Most of these big herding animals, the females don't have horns. The males have horns, and they're a bit like cowboy buckles. They're not used to defend females. They're used to brag and show off and fight each other. So how did the females protect themselves? Because the males didn't protect them. And they got into bunches because the pack hunting predator, and you've seen it on television and so on, it basically they try to isolate animals to kill them.
Right.
And then, of course, that all changed when humans came on the scene, and we were not a predator. We were an omnivore. Look at our teeth. We're omnivores. Uh-huh.
Right.
And when we came on the scene, everything changed dramatically, because not only were we an omnivore, but we had language. And no predators have language. And so we could organize and say, you go behind there, we'll go here, let's drive them here. And we also had fire, which no predators had. And we also learned that we couldn't isolate an animal from the herd easily. We're too feeble. But what we could do was drive the whole damn herd over a cliff with fire or organized right. shouting. And right. we could drive the whole herd into wetland, a bogland, whatever. So killing sites were found, places yes. in New Zealand, I believe,
yes.
up to 90,000 moas killed, only a few eaten. There are killing sites in the Americas, apparently, where thousands of buffalo were killed,
Correct.
Driven over cliffs, relatively
Correct.
Few eaten. We didn't have deep freezers and things. So right. and we were an omnivore, so we could kill out our prey because we just ate something else. So roughly 70, 80 or more percent of the genera were wiped out when humans, an omnivore with language, organization, spear, and fire came on the scene.
One of the pushbacks to this sort of practice of herd management, if you will, in the regenerative space, if these animals are then processed for human consumption, is that there's just not enough available land on the earth that can support this type of management practice.
That's just ecological ignorance.
And I'm your position would be that if we can desertify these places, then absolutely there's sufficient land to execute these kinds of practices in sufficient quantities to feed a growing population.
Well, let's dissect that a little bit.
Please.
I said to you just a bit over 100 years ago, the stocking rate with cattle in Central Texas looks like science fiction today.
Yeah, huge.
All right. The land I donated for a training entity in Zimbabwe, and I live on now, when I bought that ranch, the guy was going broke, the rancher. He had 100 head of cattle. He was very lazy, etc., and probably could have run 200. Now, the area of land isn't exactly the same now. There's been little adjustments to the border, etc., but it's fundamentally the same. Now, that same area, let's say the guy could have run 200 head of cattle the way he was doing it. And at that time, down where my home is, there's an open flay, as we call it, along a river. We could, if you'd had an elephant there, you could have seen that elephant at 300 to 500 yards any day, any time of the year. All right. Right today, I've just... raising money, we've been managing it now, just using livestock and the planned grazing, holistic planned grazing process. We've been running about five, sometimes up to 600 head, and we have got so much grass after 20 adverse years, poor rainfall years. We've got so much grass that that same site that I'm talking about, where we could have seen an elephant at 300 to 500 yards 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you cannot see an elephant at 20 to 30 yards now. That amount of production. If I could find some fairy godmother, we would buy and increase up to 2,000 head of cattle on that same land now, just to keep pace with the production of the land. If we don't, it is going to begin oxidizing.
Yeah.
And that's had international awards, Buckminster Fuller Award, Banksia International Award for the person or organization doing the most for the environment on a global scale. But as I said to you earlier, it doesn't matter how much fact,
Yeah.
doesn't matter the evidence, institutions do not change. So there's not a university in the world yet that supports that. Not a farming organization, not a ranching organization that supports that.
When you first begin to implement these processes on bare desert and you increase the stocking rate to a significant extent without a food supply or without what would appear to be a sufficient su food supply, how do you begin to start this process on bare desert?
It's a good question, Mike, and I'm often asked it, and I was asked it at the end of the TED talk.
Yeah.
We did a two advanced projects in Rhodesia where I said, look, let's try and cause holistic planned grazing process to fail, because if we can cause it to fail, then we know it's going to fail at some point. So one of the projects we took was Liebig Ranch, a average of about 12 inches of rainfall, 8 inches to 12 if you're lucky, had been as low as 4 inches. Rainfall occurring in the 3 to 4 months of the year and the rest dry. And we took the worst possible land we could find, where I offered a £5 note, that's about $10 at the time, in a 100-mile drive if anybody could find a single perennial grass. So we took bare ground, trees, leaf fall, shrubs, weeds in the rains, annual grass in the rains, if you were lucky. Now, on that, I persuaded the company to give me 4,000 acres to see if I could cause failure before we proceeded on the rest of the ranch, where we had 60,000 cows and 1.25 million acres. So 4,000 wasn't a big trial for them and was easy for them to do.
Yeah.
Now, on that 4,000 acres, that was literally the worst land we could find in the entire country. What I did was say, right, let's double the stocking rate immediately. We did, and I proved wrong. So we trebled the stocking rate. And to cut a long story short, for the next 8 years, we produced nothing but solid perennial grass, not an ounce of feed, not a And we produced 5 times as much meat per acre. And the entire cost of the development to do that was $1.80 per acre.
What are they
So
eating?
we
How?
knew this information way back in the 1960s and 70s.
So, Alan, how did you feed those cattle? What did they eat?
Mike, we didn't feed them at all. Let me explain that. Every biological function is a sigmoid curve. It's like the old story, I give you a penny today, I'm going to double it every day. Can we start? And people say, no, well, let's start tomorrow,
Right.
whatever. But it just magnifies it geometric. So if you can picture a piece of land, I won't sketch it here, but if you can picture a piece of land, if you'd had it can only it's a big piece of land, it can only hold 10 head of cattle, whatever it is, and they're eating twigs and leaf fall and whatever to stay alive. Now, if you divide that piece of land in half, then it if it could support 10 animals for 365 days of the year, now on half the land, it can take 10 on half the land for half the year. All right, so now what's that letting the plants on the other half do? The animals have gone off. It's letting those plants grow, and they grow on a sigmoid curve. All right, so if I divide it in quarters, it can take those 10 animals on quarter of the land for quarter of the year.
Right.
That leaves the plants on three quarters of the land, three quarters of the year to grow. Do you see they're growing faster?
Yes.
So all I did was I divided the land up into many small fractions. We could do that by herding. We could do it with fencing, electric, various ways. And so all I did was I had the animals moving every 1, 2, 3 days, but I was planning the recovery. So I always gave the plants 30 days at the minimum and maybe 60 days at the maximum. And I just did the simple arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
So these animals were moving around like that. And as I had 30 units of land, I just went up in stocking rate to 3 times the stocking rate. Now, if you take 3 times the stocking rate on a 30th of land, I'm not a mathematician, but I think that's about a 900% increase in stocking rate on a given day. And we had no problem at all, just grew grass. Picture it like a gardener. So a little piece of that land now had much higher concentration of cattle dunging, urinating.
Yep.
It
yep.
had their hooves chipping the surface so that seeds could grow and water could soak in.
Yep.
And then they were off it and onto the next bit of land. And by the time they were here, it had grown. Now, each piece of land that they were on, they wanted such a short period of time that they easily could live on that amount of vegetation that was in that paddock. It wasn't a problem, because two things take vegetation out of an area of land. The longer animals are there, the more is taken out of it, and the more animals. So if you increase the amount of animals, but you drastically increase the decrease the time, you're not taking any more out of it. So I hope people can make sense of that. But if you can show people on paper, it's pretty easy to do. The only time we've ever had to feed the animals is when we're doing mine reclamation. And you're dealing with soil that's come up from, you know, thousands of feet under the earth, has no seed in it, etc. And there we've just fed the cheapest possible hay full of weeds and everything. You just want seeds.
Yeah.
And just we've put up to 600 head of cattle per acre or more and just moved them across the mine dumps and plants start growing.
And so in those applications, there's no seed, but in the 4,000 acres that you'd subdivided into 30 plots, the agronomic understanding was that there was seed in there somewhere. It just needed appropriate fertilizer, tillage, urea from the cattle provided.
Mike, I think it's almost impossible to find soil in the world that hasn't got seed in it. I believe soil's been taken out between the planks in ships sunk off the coast of America. I think I'm correct in saying 300 years ago, and seeds germinated from that soil between the planks. I had a discussion with a professor of range science, I think it was in Nevada some years ago, and he was telling me how we could not possibly do this in Nevada because it's so vast, so many areas are desertifying so badly. And he said, there's no seed. And I said, all right, then go out anywhere at random and scrape off the top centimeter or so of soil, put it in trays, take it into your lab and water it. And if nothing germinates, comes up, I'll send you $1,000. Well, he never claimed his $1,000. I don't think you can find soil that has no seed.
Yeah. Can I describe for you, to maybe start to bring this back full circle, some of the programs that military veterans are doing both with the Department of Defense and outside of it? There's an active duty major in the Camp San Luis Obispo area who is managing 2,500 acres of land using 140 cow-calf pairs in an adaptive multi-paddock grazing way, which is very similar, if not the same, that you have described in the past about herded animals being moved in planned ways. And he is doing so on an Army National Guard base. And the prior landowners had been practicing traditional open grazing systems. And he moves these animals once, sometimes twice a day. And in the last 3 or 4 months he's been doing it, he has seen incredible improvements, not just in the soil, but in the grasslands itself, in the ecological systems that are coming back, wildlife and birds in ways that these previous land managers have never seen before. The plan, right, is that the Department of Defense manages somewhere in the nature of 26 million acres in the United States. And by manage, I just mean either lands that are adjacent to these bases that are required for buffers for live fire zone areas, but then also acreage that is not acreage that is on the base itself that's not currently in live fire status, et cetera. And 13 million of those 26 belong to the US Army. And if this particular major can begin to show that these practices are having ecological and land benefits on and around the base itself, then he feels confident that these practices can be replicated across other military bases. Camp Roberts, for example, is, a couple hours away, and it's 40,000 acres. There are military veterans who are running nonprofits who take interested transitioning veterans and teach them how to do horseback and how to manage ranches. Now, they're still doing it traditional ways, but there is strong interest in the veteran community to come back to the ranching space and to learn these skills because they find purpose in them again in ways that they often struggle to find after they leave active duty service. And this sense of being a part of something greater than themselves and having, long-term good is lost in some ways. There are career transition programs that allow veterans through the last 6 months of their time to serve as an unpaid intern, meaning the company that takes them or the organization that takes them doesn't pay for them. The DoD still pays for their time to come and learn about regenerative agriculture or ranching or these sort of holistic practices, and then take up professions in them when they transition out.
I think, Mike, that's an incredible idea, and I think incredible good can come out of it. I'd just be all for it. Oh, they can be given tremendous help. I loved what you were saying. And if they want to get into regenerative agriculture, wonderful. There are over 600 branches or organizations now, regenerative in the world.
Wow.
All of those came from Bob Rodale and myself. I'd love to help you with it because none of them are addressing the root cause of the problem. They're all doing wonderful work promoting farmer production of food based on the biological sciences, but we talked about that earlier. That's not addressing the cause of the problem. So if your vets, etc., want to get involved, again, just go to the original. We'll work with you. The Epps Avery Institute will work with you and as fast as possible train your own people. So you're training your own people. We have hubs, 50 hubs around the world in 30 countries. It'd be wonderful to have some veteran hubs run by veterans where we train your people and you train your own people. All that can be done for you. And
Would you
just talk to us, Avery Institute. Do it through Ken.
or Ken maybe be open to this, the idea of this sort of skills bridge type relationship with transitioning veterans and a Savory Institute type hub, right? Where we bring some transitioning veterans in and they serve at no cost to the Savory Institute for several months of their final internship. And they're educated in the process, but they also support your organization. And then when that internship is over, decide if there's an employment opportunity or they transition out and go into put these practices to work. I mean, would something like that with the Savory Institute be potentially interesting?
Tremendously appealing, and my mind's already running ahead creatively. The Savory Institute could help you with that. It could put you in touch with these hubs around the world, you know, in all over the world, in Eastern Europe, everywhere. People could be training in those, getting other experience. The Africa Center hub where I live, people could be training there and gaining knowledge to be able to work anywhere in Africa. They could be doing it on the basis you do. And please, there isn't a bigger problem facing humanity. This is bigger than all wars ever fought. This degradation of human environment, biodiversity loss is in free fall. Yeah. And so, yes, we'll give you all the help you can to train people, develop your own hubs. You design it. We'll help you design it. And we can, as I say, help you get these people trained in other countries as well to give experience. It would be wonderful. It's just incredible.
How do you stay so positive, Alan, in the face of such a struggle to change and sort of being met with constant apathy? How do you continue to drive this forward? Where do you find that drive in you?
I've actually been asked that question many, many times because I've been the memoir that will hopefully be released soon, the actual title is Unsavory, because I've been so unsavory throughout my life, militarily, scientifically, politically, etc. Yes, I've faced obstacles all my life while sticking to trying to solve this problem, regardless of the opposition. And so I've often been asked that question and really had to ponder it. And I put it down to one word, caring. And I think any of your listeners, I hope they'll understand this. If you care enough about your family, if you care enough about your nation, your country, your community, you will do whatever you have to do, including giving up your life. And I cared enough about my nation. I cared enough about wildlife. I cared enough about communities, my family. And when I realized the magnitude of this problem when I was 20, 21, I changed my whole career. And I decided I will devote my life to solving this problem, no matter if it costs me my life. So I put it down to one word, caring. And many people listen to us, I believe, care deeply. If they do, they'll follow up.
That brings us to the end of part two with Alan Savory, and the close of a conversation that was as bold and unfiltered as the man himself. In this half of the interview, Alan didn't just talk about theory. He challenged the very frameworks that have shaped modern environmental and agricultural thinking for decades. He reminded us that properly managed livestock are not the problem, they are the solution. That without them, we have nothing in the human toolbox capable of reversing desertification at scale. And he laid out the path forward, a future led not by institutions clinging to outdated models, but by people, many of whom could be military veterans, who know how to lead, adapt, and fight for results on the ground. If this conversation got you thinking differently, that's the point. If it challenged what you've been taught, even better. To learn more about Alan's work, visit savory.global, where you can dive into holistic management, land-to-market programs, and how you can get involved, whether you're a rancher, policymaker, military veteran, or someone just getting started. Also, be on the lookout for Alan's memoir, Unsavory, in the coming weeks. If you're interested in helping link together the Savory Institute, the DoD Skills Bridge Program, or other collaborative ideas or programs, please reach out to me to discuss further. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.